Well, if you have a Bible, please do open with me to Exodus chapter 3. We're going to read this chapter as we continue on in our series through the book of Exodus. And what a chapter we come to this morning. This great revelation of the glory of God in the burning bush. Please do follow along or follow along on the screens. Exodus chapter 3, verse 1. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, "I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned." When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." And he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He said, "But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" God also said to Moses, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. And I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God.' But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. And so I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty, but each woman shall ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, and so you shall plunder the Egyptians." This is the word of the Lord. I remember as a young Christian being powerfully struck by the opening words of A.W. Tozer's book, The Knowledge of the Holy. Here's what the opening line of that book says. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. Worship is pure or base as the worshiper entertains high or low thoughts of God. I remember reading that as a young Christian and just being bowled over. And I started to think, what does come into my mind as I just start to think about God? I want you to pause for a moment as we begin and think. What comes into your mind when you think about God? Do you think of God as an abstract deity who's kind of really far off? Do you think of a grandfather-type figure in a rocking chair in the sky who kind of wags his finger and chuckles at the unruly humans? Do you think of God as an angry dictator sitting there with his arms folded and his brow furrowed, and all we are trying to do is try to make him happy with us? What comes into your mind when you think of God? The book of Exodus is given to answer the question, who is this God we worship? What is he really like? And if we want to think right thoughts about God, we must strive to see him as he has revealed himself to us in his word. Not just how we want him to be or how we imagine him to be in our own minds. Here in Exodus chapter 3, we have one of the highest revelations of God's nature in the whole of the Old Testament. In chapters 1 and 2, we have observed the subtle but steady, faithful, behind-the-scenes God. The God who cares for his people in affliction. The God who knows his people's struggles. Now as we move on forward into chapters 3 and 4, we move into the call and the commissioning of Moses. And the first stage of the call and commissioning of Moses consists of God coming down to make himself known to Moses. And as we walk through this morning, I want you to be asking God in your heart even now, Lord, give me eyes to see you, to see what you want me to see here. Because as God reveals himself to Moses, this has been inscripturated, written down so that we can see this great revelation of God and we can see him so that in our minds, when we think about God, we're thinking about him rightly in a way that will lead us to worship him in reverence and awe. And we really need this vision of God. Because if we have a small vision of God, a distant vision of God, then our God will have a small part in our lives. And we will live a life that is kind of far away from him. What comes into your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about you. Because if you're thinking rightly about God, you will worship him rightly. If you are not thinking rightly about him, you will not worship him rightly. So I want us to be asking him this morning, Lord, let me see you as you've revealed yourself here. And what we're going to do is focus on just the first 15 verses of this chapter. And we'll see God revealed as, first, the God who is not far off. He does not stand far off from his people. Then we're going to see this God whose great name reveals a great nature. And then thirdly, we're going to see that this God is with his people. And that includes all of us who are his in their weakness. So, first, the God who does not stand off from his people. You'll see that the chapter now opens with Moses out in the wilderness of Midian, where we left off with him last time, tending the flocks of his father-in-law, Jethro. Imagine him in the wilderness, that one day he's going to lead the flock of the people of Israel through. Imagine him leading his flock, seeking pasture. Where's the rain falling? Where's there fresh pasture for the flock? And he goes across to the far side of the wilderness, we're told, to a place called Horeb. It's another name for Mount Sinai, the mountain that's going to be the setting from chapter 19 right through to the end of the book. It's here called the Mountain of God. As Moses leads his flock over to the foot of Horeb, we read in verse 2 that the angel of the Lord, notice that language, the angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in a flame of fire within a bush. And the narrator tells us the bush was burning, but it was not burning up. And you've got to fix that into your mind. In the dryness of the wilderness, a bush would have just burnt and burnt out in moments. This bush was burning and burning and burning, but never burning out. And the angel of the Lord speaks and appears to Moses from within the bush. Now, the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament is a mysterious person. In verse 3, you'll notice the angel of the Lord is also referred to as the Lord himself and God. And so it seems, and we see this other in other places in the Old Testament, when the angel of the Lord is present, the Lord himself, God, is present. The angel of the Lord is God, and yet is distinct from God. Does that remind you of anyone? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and yet the Word was God. We can't read too much into it, but it certainly catches our attention that at the height of the revelation of God in the Old Testament, there is this mysterious figure of the angel of the Lord who is God and yet is distinct from God. This has led many to think that what we have here is some kind of pre-incarnate glimpse of the eternal Word coming down as the mediator. Well, in verse 4, Moses, seeing the sight of the burning bush, and it must have stood out to him, he goes over to see this strange sight of a bush that's burning, but unlike all the others that would be in kind of forest fire type situations, this bush was not burning out. And from the bush, God calls to him and says, "Moses, Moses," and Moses just simply says, "Here I am." And now God sets the tone straight away by giving two clear instructions to Moses in verse 5. First, don't come near. Second, take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Now, it was an ancient custom of the day to take off sandals as a mark of reverence and respect. So the tone being set here is very clear. Moses still doesn't know who's speaking to him, but he is in the presence of one who commands reverence and respect. And then in verse 6 comes the introduction. "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And what does Moses do? He just covers. He covers his face for fear. And then look at how God proceeds to speak in verse 7, reflecting all the verbs and the words we saw in chapter 2, verses 23 and 24. God now says, "I've seen the affliction of my people. I've heard their cry. I know their sufferings." Isn't that beautiful? The first glimpse we have here is of burning holiness. But this burning holy one says, I have seen the affliction. I've heard their cry. I know their suffering. And look in verse 8 at what this God says. I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land. It's so simple, but isn't it beautiful? God says, I have come down to bring them up. I'm moving towards them to bring them to me. Though this God is holy, he is not a God who stands off from his people. He could have stayed in heaven to deliver his people. He could have stood afar off and just directed Pharaoh's heart where he would want it to go. But no, he does not stand off and direct things from afar. He steps down. I have come down now to enter the suffering and the affliction of my people. This is the God who is holy, but who steps down into our pain. And this is the same God that we worship this morning. He does not change. A God who is touched by the feeling of our infirmities. When he says, I know their suffering, it's not just mental knowledge or acknowledgement. It is, I know. Deep in my soul, I know. I am touched by the feeling of my people's infirmities, their weakness. I know. Intimately, I am intimately acquainted with your pain. Imagine what this experience must have been like for Moses. It would have been surreal, scary, surprising, but then there must have been something of excitement that would have risen up in his heart as he hears the Almighty God saying, I'm coming down to rescue my people. It's all going so well, and then God drops the bombshell in verse 10. So now go, Moses. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Moses cannot believe what God has just said. He cannot understand it to be right, and so he protests, saying, I am not the right man for the job. But God reassures him of his presence with him. But Moses needs more. And this is where we move on from seeing the God who comes down to his people to seeing the God whose great name reveals his great nature. In verse 13, Moses says to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Now, we've seen that names are really important in the book of Exodus. The Hebrew title for the book actually is, These Are the Names. We've seen Moses, which meant kind of fished up out of water. We've seen his son named Gershom, foreigner in a foreign land. Shipra and Pua in the opening chapter, sparkling, beautiful, and they stand out like gems in that opening chapter. So names in this culture spoke of the nature of the person named. Moses now, struggling to comprehend what God is calling him to do in being the one to go to Pharaoh, he needs to know more of who this God is who's speaking to him and calling him to go to Pharaoh. Moses, in asking for God's name, is essentially asking for God's nature. Think about it. Moses is a baby was taken away from his cultural background amongst the Israelites. He was raised for 40 years in the wisdom, ways, and religion of the Egyptians. Another 40 years, he's taken out of Egypt and he's wandering around in Midian. His father Jethro is a priest of Midian, a priest of whatever the religion was that was being acknowledged there amongst the Midianites. What would Moses have known of God? What would he have known of Israel? What would he have known of his heritage? He certainly knew something, because as we acknowledged in the last chapters, he went out among his brothers, and he knew that he was an Israelite. But what would he really have known of God? 40 years brainwashing amongst the Egyptians, 40 years amongst the Midianites. And now, of course, he needs to know, God, who are you? You're the God of my fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You're the God of my people, but I don't know who you are. I don't know your nature. Are you one among others? And so Moses says, when they ask me, what's his name? What's your name? What should I tell them? And in verse 14, we get God's answer. God said to Moses, I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel. I am has sent me to you. Now, this divine giving of the name is really central in Exodus. The name given from the burning bush that is burning but is not burning out reveals to us so much about the nature of God. We could just identify now point after point about the profound nature of God given in this statement, I am who I am. When I've been studying this week, though I probably could have taken about 10 profound aspects of the nature of God revealed in the giving of his name here, I've tried to collapse it down into simply three. So what I want us to do now, though I don't typically do this when dealing with narrative, is just hit the pause button on the flow of the narrative. And let's just stand at the burning bush for a while. And let's hear God say, I am who I am. And ponder for a moment, what is he revealing of his nature in the giving of his name? First, we see in the giving of the divine name, I am who I am, that this God is self-existing, self-sufficient. Now, to really see this, to get what I mean here, we need to keep in mind that Moses is hearing God speaking to him through the powerful image of the burning bush. It's burning and burning with no outside fuel source. Now, Lindsay and I went camping in the summer, and we had a little gas stove with two little plate lit things on it, whatever you call them, hobs. And from that little gas stove, we had a little orange tube that ran down into our little gas canister. And as long as there was gas in that little canister, and it was coming up into the little burner, there was a flame there that burnt. But if we ran out of gas, or if you disconnected the gas supply, you had no flame at all. You'll notice that the burning bush does not have any little tubes coming out of it. It is not running down into any source that needs to keep the flame burning. And the message here is loud and clear. In fact, the medium is part of the message. When God says, I am, he is saying, I simply exist. I do not depend on anyone or anything for my existence. There is no need for any outside fuel source to keep me burning. I am simply burning with holiness, and that holiness never burns out. It does not need anything to stoke the fire or keep it going. I am. I exist. I depend on no one and nothing for my existence. That sets God apart completely from everything else in existence. This sets the creator and the creature apart, because all of us depend on someone or something else for our existence. In fact, every single animate and inanimate object in the universe depends on something else for its existence. When God, in the burning bush that is burning and burning and not burning out, says, I am who I am, he is saying, I am the self-existing one, the self-sufficient one. I am totally different from everyone and everything else. I am. And so from the bush, Moses hears this revelation, and the message is clear. Little children sometimes ask, who made God? And you see, that makes the mistake of assuming that God is in the category of things created, things that derive their existence from some other thing. But God is not in that category at all. In fact, what makes God, God, is that he does not need anyone to create him. He is eternally, forever, infinitely in all directions, he is. God is the author of all life without exception. Nothing exists without him. Nothing starts without him. He is an unmoved mover, the one who moves and everything else moves. He himself does not need anything to move him. Nothing, no author preceded him. He is the fountain of all that is, and he is a fountain that needs no maintenance. Now, are you thinking rightly about this God? There is a popular idea that God created mankind out of some need in himself. Poor old God, who needs humanity, has lost control of his unruly people, and he just wishes he could get them back. Poor old God needs our help to get things done in his world, and I can help him. Well, Paul made this clear in Acts 17:25. This God is not served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives life to all mankind and breath and everything else. Let's be totally clear here this morning. God does not need our help. We need his help. God is not greater for our existing, and he would not be less if we did not exist. Are you thinking rightly about this God? That's the God you bow down to pray to when you're in your room by yourself. That's the God we are singing holy, holy, holy to this morning. Self-existing one, self-sufficient, burning with holiness, never burning out, in a category all of his own. Second thing we learn about the nature of God in this statement, I am who I am, is simply this. This God is incomparable. Or we could use the word holy. God says to Moses, I am who I am. You'll see in the footnote of your Bible that can be translated a variety of ways. I will be who I will be, etc., etc. But the point for every translation is simply the same. It's just the difficulty of grappling. What's God saying when he's using the verb to be? Saying just, I am who I am. The point when he says, I am who I am, is the same, no matter how it is translated. The point is simply this. God is saying, I am in a league of my own. Incomparable. Think of all the ways we define ourselves. Let's just think of me. I'm Steve. I am the son of Roy and Lola. I am the brother to Karen and Wendy. I am married to Lindsay. I am the father to Hudson, Elliot, and Grace. Think of all the ways we define ourselves. We might say, I'm single. I'm married. I'm a pastor. We define ourselves by other people. And we define ourselves by what we do, our jobs. What does God do when he comes to define himself? Because there is no one he can compare himself to. There is no one he can say, I'm like this, I'm like this. You know this really good person? I'm like them. You know, no, he can't. He just has to say, I am who I am. I cannot be compared to anyone. I cannot be defined in relation to anyone or anything. I can only define myself by myself. God, we can say reverently, is cut from a different cloth. He is totally different. And the Bible uses a word to describe this attribute of God, and it is this word, holy. Holiness speaks of both the majesty of God and the moral purity of God. Once again, keep in mind how the burning bush backdrop reinforces the message. Do you ever at school play with, I shouldn't say play with, did you ever do experiments with Bunsen burners at school? And what did you do? You closed that little bit at the bottom, and that stopped the air from going through, and the flame would be orange and a bit smoky, and it wouldn't be the clean frame. And then you could open it and let the air through, and suddenly it would burn blue or even white hot at times, and it would be a purifier. You see, what you have in the burning bush here, and it burning and not burning the bush out, is God's revelation that he is holy, pure fire. Refining, purity, burning like the sun. We who are impure cannot come too close. We can't approach, or we would be burned up in his purity. And so when Moses stands in the presence of the Holy One, he needed to be careful. He covered his face. God said, don't come any closer. Take the sandals off your feet. This is holy ground you are standing on. Do you think like this about God? When you bow down to pray, I am coming before the Holy One. This is the majestic one. His holiness speaks of him being set apart completely, but his holiness also speaks of his moral purity, the fact that he is pure and free from all evil. In 1 John 1:5, John writes, God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. Holiness is an essential part of the nature of God. It means he does not just always and perfectly know what is right. He always and perfectly does what is right. Imagine for a moment with me if God possessed omnipotence, all power, omniscience, perfect and complete knowledge, omnipresence, he's everywhere present. Imagine if he had all those attributes, but he did not have holiness. Such a being would not be God, and such a being would not inspire confidence, for he could exercise all of this power in a way that was malevolent or evil. God's holiness is the perfection of all of his other attributes. His power is holy power. His mercy is holy mercy. His justice is holy justice. His wisdom is holy wisdom. His hatred of evil is a holy hatred of evil. And the absolute holiness of God is to be of great assurance to us. If God is holy, then we can know that all of his actions towards us are always, always perfect and just. Jerry Bridges has said, it is his holiness more than any other attribute that makes him worthy of our praise. But we know that God demands more than we just simply acknowledge his holiness. He says to us, be holy. For I am holy. And in this way, and in this calling, His holiness should strike reverential fear in each of our hearts this morning. If God is holy, He can never excuse or overlook or simply brush under the mat any sin in His creatures, however small it may be. Every act of unholiness taints everything He has created and made. It is no longer a pure universe if there is a trace of sin in it. And we have a great problem this morning in that each of us have unholiness and sin in our lives. How can we, a sinful people, ever stand in the presence of a holy God? We need God Himself to make a way. We need God to change our status from unholy and unclean to holy and clean. Just hold that thought for a while. Now, I am who I am. This God is self-existing. This God is holy and incomparable. And the third lesson we can draw from this great revelation of God's name is that this God is eternal. The words, "I am who I am," tell us that God is eternal. There was never a time when God was not. He simply is. C.S. Lewis gives a very helpful illustration here. Imagine a big roll of paper rolling out, let's go this way, infinitely in this direction to your left and infinitely in this direction. That's eternality. Then imagine taking a pencil and drawing a little line on it. That's all of time as we know it. And God is there from everlasting to everlasting. He is the Alpha, the Omega. He is the author of all time and everything that happens on that little line. And He is the one who at the end will draw that time as we know it to a conclusion. He is eternal. Isn't it just beautiful that the one psalm we have that we know was assigned to Moses is Psalm 90, "Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." And what did Moses say just before that? "In all generations, you have been our dwelling place." Why is the eternality of God comforting? Well, why is it comforting to Moses? Because God is from everlasting to everlasting, I know that there is an everlasting place of rest and refuge for me. And isn't it lovely that Moses would write that? He didn't really know a home as a boy. He was a foreigner in Egypt. He didn't really know a home then for 40 years in the wilderness. He was a foreigner in Midian. He then leads the people through the wilderness for another 40 years, and just as he's about to come home, he doesn't make it. And so he concludes, "Well, Lord, you're my home." And the eternality of God is such good news to Moses because he knows from everlasting to everlasting, God is my resting place. So, we have quickly moved through this revelation of God, the great name that shows the great nature. He's self-existing, He's holy, He's incomparable, He is eternal. But what I want to do now is ask, what in this narrative are we to take from this revelation? As in, Steve, you've had us up here with all this high theology of the being and nature and attributes of God. What does that mean for me this week? That's where the core message at the heart of this chapter is so stunning. And we come to the third revelation in the section, the God who comes down, the God whose name reveals His nature. Now we see the God who is with His people. To see this point, you need to just look at the structure of chapter 3 briefly. In verses 1 to 9, we think of it in three blocks. Verses 1 to 9, you have the God who comes down. Then skip from 13 to 22, the second half, and you have the divine name given and the mission unpacked for Moses. And then you got this amazing section, verses 10 to 12, in the middle of this sandwich. So the God who comes down, the mission and the name of God unfolded, and now 10 to 12, the heart of this chapter. In verse 10, we've already noticed that God says, okay, Moses, I want you to go to Pharaoh and I want you to lead this great deliverance. And look at Moses' words in verse 11. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring Israel out of Egypt? Now, Moses, of course, feels weak, inadequate, ill-equipped to face what God has appointed for him. I wonder, do you know what that feels like? In your frailty, in your sickness, in your family situation, in that sort of impossible loneliness that's there, your anxiety, whatever it is, I wonder, do you know what it is to feel inadequate, weak, that maybe you find yourself often saying, I just don't know if I can cope. And here's what God says in verse 12. But I will be with you. Now remember, I am can be translated, your wee footnote tells you, I am who I am, I will be who I will be. When God says, I am who I am, it is exactly the same phrase, I am, used in verse 12. You could translate it, I am with you. And I think this is the heart of this chapter and the heart that God has for us this morning. In all of your inadequacy, in all of your fear, in all the I can't cope, in all the struggles with parenting, in all the struggles with your unsaved friends or family members, in everything that's before you, I think the point here is, I am with you. All that God is revealed to be in this chapter, the self-sufficient, self-existing one, the one that depends on no one or nothing, the holy and incomparable one who burns with purity and righteousness, the one who is eternal, our eternal home, says, all that I am is with you in what you're facing. All that uncertainty, all that unfear, all that bereavement, all that grief, I am with you, for you, on your side, never going to let you go, never going to let you fall, never going to leave your side. I am with you. Moses, you're not going into Pharaoh alone. I am with you. And who is Pharaoh before me? What is your Pharaoh that God is calling you to face this morning? God says, I am calling you to this. It's no accident. It just hasn't come into your life randomly or accidentally while God was not looking. He is ordaining everything that is coming to pass. And he says, in what I'm ordaining for you, I am with you. Holiness, eternality, self-sufficiency, all that I am, I'm with you. As you face this life alone, this fear of singleness, this cancer, this impending death, this difficult relationship at work, this difficult family situation, your fear of getting older, know the Almighty says, I see, I hear, I am intimately acquainted with your infirmity, your weakness. All that I am is here for you. That rocked me when I saw that this week in my study. It changes everything. Everything in our lives. In Hebrews 13:5, God says, never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. And I have found it so helpful to think the God of the burning bush is standing right by my side even in this. And though your resources may falter,
His will never falter. And all of those resources are there for you, even in this. Now, my time has gone, but let me just close in this. Where in history is the only other place where the name I am and God with us come together? John 8:58, when the Jews are boasting about their connection to Abraham, Jesus says, "Before Abraham was, I am." And the Jews pick up stones to stone him because they know he's just said, "The God who said, I am who I am, that is me." When Jesus was born in Matthew 1:23, what name did they give him? Jesus, because he'll save his people from their sins, and they shall give him the name Emmanuel, God with us. Here in the burning bush, we have, for me, one of the most beautiful pictures of the incarnation of Jesus Christ. So next time you read or think of burning bush, you think of the baby in the manger. He is the burning bush. He is the one who burns with holiness and does not burn out. He is the holy I am, veiled in flesh for a time. The holy I am, come down to deliver his people from their greatest problem, not slavery in Egypt, the slavery to sin and moral impurity. And this holy I am comes down to set us free. This holy I am touches us and does not himself become contaminated, but instead he gives us his holiness. The great high priest who is touched by our infirmities comes down to pay our holiness debt so that we can be pronounced holy. And so this morning, as we go off into this week, whatever is that is causing you that fear and anxiety, the Lord wants you to know that he, that holy God, is with you. You don't face it alone. And he wants you to know, if you're feeling burdened by impurity and uncleanness and unholiness, Jesus Christ is the one who can touch you and make you pure. That's the greatest news in all the universe. In Jesus, you're made holy, declared holy, so you can stand. And what does God say? He doesn't just want us to come as paupers. He doesn't want us to come as slaves, cowering as we come. He wants us to come with confidence, standing in the presence of the Lord, the holy, raging inferno of glory and holiness. He says, in my Son, you can stand confidently because you are made holy in him. All your sin wiped away. And this Holy One says, call me Father. This takes us right back to where we started. What comes into your mind when you think of God? Have you reduced and domesticated this God to something small and distant, and so your relationship is marked by smallness and indifference? Or have you put together these worlds of huge eternality, incomparable holiness, transcendent high, and yet the one who says, I've come down. Call me Father. Let's make sure this week, as we bow to pray, or we bow to read our Bible, or we come this evening again to church, let's make sure we are thinking rightly about this God. And let me urge you, when you come to church, anytime you come, this used to happen in days gone by. There's a lot of noise and stuff. I would really encourage you, when you come into church and sit down, just go into your own little world for a moment and remember who you're coming to worship. Sunday by Sunday. Sometimes we just rush, we're just boo, 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 and then suddenly, holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. It's as if we haven't even thought of the Lord, this holy God. So let me urge you, keep making sure that what comes into your mind when you think about God is what God has revealed of himself from this book. Let's not shape him in our image. Let's let ourselves be shaped in his image. Let's pray. Father, if you marked our transgressions, none of us could stand. But with you, there is forgiveness, that you might be feared. You are holy, but you have come down to make us holy so that we could come to you and know you as our holy Father. Give us both the fear of holiness and the intimate confidence of sons and daughters as we worship you in reverence and awe and in the splendor of holiness. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.